This is an ABC podcast.
Erin Longbottom is a nurse. She works at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. But mostly, Erin goes to meet the patients where they live. And they tend to live on the streets and in the parks of Sydney. Sometimes they're in refuges, or if they're lucky, they'll have made it out of homelessness and into public housing. Erin's work is all about addressing the priorities of homeless people, which can get easily scrambled. She says a person who's homeless often has far more urgent needs, like finding somebody to eat, working out how to get money, or finding a bed for the night, than tending to that nasty scratch on the leg, or that pain in the back, or that migraine that just seems to be getting worse. All this means that a health crisis can become horribly severe or even life-threatening before that person goes and looking for help. Erin manages the homelessness unit at St Vincent's Hospital. She and her colleagues spend every day trying to care for people who often have nobody else to tell them that they should really go and see a doctor. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Richard.
Let's start with one of your first cases. Your very first case, in fact, was a young guy. Tell me a bit about him.
Yes, he was a New Zealand Cook Islander, and I met him actually after he was admitted to hospital. So we have a partner service that we work with who flagged him with me and said, look, he's in hospital, we're really concerned about him, can you go and follow him up? So I went and met him in the intensive care unit. And what had happened was is that he had been admitted after, I guess, being quite unwell for a long period of time, but because he had a sort of limited understanding around his health needs, and I think because he didn't have any access to healthcare in Australia because he had no Medicare and no support really because he was sleeping rough under the bridge, he'd really missed the signs and symptoms of having a very, very large brain tumour.
Oh my God, a brain tumour?
Yeah.
So he was getting like powerful headaches and didn't know what they were or how to even get help for them?
Essentially. Yes. So he had no family support. He was extremely socially isolated. He had a street family, as it were, and they were the ones that eventually took him to a free medical clinic in the inner city and got him some help, as it were. He saw a doctor who sent him for a CT scan.
Had he been trying to self-medicate with his
headache? He had. He'd been trying to self-medicate with lots of different types of substances. So he'd been using some cannabis, some alcohol, and some crystal methamphetamine as well. So he'd really essentially, he'd only used a little bit of crystal meth because he probably couldn't really afford very much, and it was because he didn't have any income. But he'd, I think, been really just trying whatever he could do to try and get rid of these headaches.
How old was this guy?
So he was, at the time that I met him, he was 24.
Right. And he was in terrible trouble and had no one to support him.
Yes.
Did he have any kind of intellectual disability at all?
Yes. So it turns out in the end that he did have an intellectual disability. So I was able to track down his records from New Zealand, his education records. And it was a very, very, very sad day that I read through those. He'd literally been a street kid in New Zealand. He'd not, again, had a big family, but they had to go out and steal food to eat, never really had a stable home, had been through lots and lots of different schools, been put from one family member to another, and ended up coming to Australia, I think, because they just didn't know what to do with him. So they sent him to family in Australia, where he'd essentially stayed with a few family members who, and then he had a pretty tricky time there where essentially it sounds like he was underwent some significant trauma at the hands of one of his uncles and then left.
Like sexual abuse or something like that?
It's likely that it was sexual abuse, alleged sexual abuse, yes. And he ended up on the street. So he left there, stayed in a boarding house, had a job, but because he couldn't cope with working because of his headaches, he lost his job, didn't really have the intellectual ability to get onto Medicare. He'd been quite sort of looked after by his family, but then because he became isolated, he didn't have any income, he didn't have Medicare, he didn't really have anything or the capacity to be able to link into those services and supports.
Oh, Erin, does your heart go out to this guy? What a hellish life he's
Yeah, no, it was that very, to be honest with you, when I was working with him, I often had tears in my eyes listening to his story. And he really struggled with his memory, so it often just came back to him in waves of recollection, if, as it were. So we would be talking and he would say, you know, this is what my mother used to do and this is what my grandmother used to do and this is where I lived. And but it took quite a long time for me to actually piece all this together.
So this is on a classic case of someone who's fallen really deep between the cracks of society. Where so what happened? Was the hospital able to treat his brain tumour?
Yeah, well, the hospital was amazing, essentially. They looked after him. There was a social worker on the ward who managed to get apply for income. And then, obviously, because he had like quite a lot of neurological testing, which showed that he had significant deficits in the area of so many areas, and that he needed really to be appointed a public guardian for decision making and also a financial manager to manage his financial situation. So this didn't happen to him again.
So did he need that guardian's consent to have a brain operation then, or did that just happen anyway?
So I think that was able to be done under sort of, you know,
emergency situation,
yeah. But so essentially once the public guardian was put into place, that was more around all the other things that needed to happen.
I don't know if you know anything about his condition, but I wonder if this was the longest building brain tumour or a long-standing thing or something that had popped up over a series of months or thereabouts.
It was a long time, but I do know that when he came in, I think it was one of the largest that the neuro team had seen. God. It was very, very, very large. So when the initial neurological testing neuropsychological testing showed that essentially he had these deficits, and it would improve over time, but there was definitely still underlying intellectual disability likely.
And that was associated with the tumour then?
It was a pre-existing one, which meant that it was easier for him almost in some ways to get funding later down the track that he had a pre-existing intellectual disability.
So was the surgery successful then?
The surgery was successful, but it didn't stop the headaches. So for a very, very long time. So he had so many strengths. He was an amazing young guy. He was fit and he valued, you know, like his physical appearance and fitness and so many, you know, he had such a, I guess, joy for life in so many ways, but it was really debilitating to him experiencing these headaches. Right. They were really debilitating. So we went through just a huge amount of things. After he was released from hospital, we went through just a massive process to try and manage his pain. That was quite a significant thing for him.
But he was homeless. Where could he stay after his operation?
Exactly. So he was in a really desperate situation when he came in. He had no bank account, no Medicare, no ID, no money. He essentially had nothing. He just had the shirt on his back and some clothes. So we had to start going through that whole process with him, getting him a bank account, getting him ID, getting him Medicare. But the financial situation meant that he ended up, it takes time. So there was nowhere for him to go and he can't stay in hospital for months.
And he can't go back under the harbour bridge after a brain surgery, no.
He certainly can't. So we have a little crisis accommodation service at St Vincent's Hospital called Tierney House. And usually it's just 1 or 2 weeks that somebody's sort of allowed to stay there. But he was the longest stayer ever. He stayed there for 9 months. And that was really because he was able to get permission from the CEO to stay there for a length of time because of his special case.
How much did he come to depend on you, Erin?
Now, that was very challenging, actually, because there was no other support service for him at the time, and he needed daily support. So essentially, I was providing him with daily support,
What is that? What support do you mean?
So I would have to, so I did a lot of things, I guess, to try and help that. So putting quite strict routines in place for him so he knew where to go because he had that intellectual disability and he also had the added complication that he'd had the brain surgery and there were still some deficits there. He ended up needing to have sort of quite regimented routines.
So you just have to be mum, in other words.
Yes, I was, yeah.
You had to sort of plan his day for him
and
say,
he would call me multiple times a day, you know, and, you know, sort of, I guess, for example, showing how vulnerable he was that when we opened a bank account for him, and it was my naivety too, because I didn't even think about this. He got given a debit card with a Visa debit card.
Oh, no,
He went online and started online dating and paying for all these things online, sort of with no concept that he didn't have the income for this. And so that was quite an interesting experience for me. But it did mean having to counsel him through some, and you know, it was sort of like, yeah, really like looking after a teen, or sort of supporting a teenager almost.
So then you had to get what that out of his hands and...
So essentially we just, he ended up having a financial manager, but we were able to just say, look, we need to just make it a debit card. So you're just a key card. So you're just using your money that you have in your account, until he got his financial manager and he was able to be sort of help with really budgeting. We had to just sort of help him make sure he didn't blow his money every week.
And what was he like to deal with temperamentally?
He was the most lovely, gentle, sweet boy. I've never ever seen him ever really get angry. Got a little bit upset from time to time about, because he was, I guess, you know, looking for love and he wanted connection and human connection. So he would try and find girls to date, and that would always upset him because it never seemed to really last very long for him. And so I think, you know, his quest for human connection got him a little bit upset at times. But apart from that, he was just such a pleasure to work with.
Did he ask you to marry him at any stage?
No, he was always very good. I think I was much more of a mother figure to him.
How did you help him connect with his family after a while?
So it was really interesting, actually. We got him involved with a volunteer organisation who took him to a rugby game because he was really into league. It was for psychosocial support, so they used to take him out and they'd take him to games and take him to do things. And he was at a rugby game in Campbelltown and he ran into his family, but not the family that he'd had the issue with, some other family. And he connected with them and then he found out where his mother was, and it was just such a random act of fate. It was really incredible. So,
are you still in contact with him?
He still comes back to visit me, yes. Yeah.
The fact that he didn't have family and then found some family, is that a key issue when it comes to homeless people here? The lack of networks, friendship and family networks around homeless people?
That is the key issue, Richard, I would say.
That's the thing a great many homeless people have in common.
Yeah, that is what causes so many things. It causes mental health issues. It causes drug and alcohol issues. It causes health issues in general. It causes so many things, that lack of human connection, the social isolation. So the way that I look at it is that if I was to lose my job or have a drug and alcohol issue or go through a severe trauma or have, you know, something happened to me and end up with no income and needing to, you know, losing my house, losing my job, I would have a family and friends who would have my back. They would let me stay on their couch. And, you know, I think the problem is for so many of our clients, my clients, and for people experiencing homelessness, is that when they have a trauma or when all the trauma that's happened to them in the past and they end up with a drug and alcohol issue or a mental health issue, they just don't have anywhere to go. They don't have anyone that's got their back. They don't have the social supports. And every single person you see just about that I work with is socially isolated, socially isolated, socially isolated. So it's really, I think, a real key issue. And so many people don't have a next of kin or anybody to contact. The amount of times I get a phone call about someone that has put me down as a contact for housing because they have nobody else to put down.
I'm, as you're saying this, I'm just wondering if this is becoming an epidemic, because you know, all the social stats we have tell us that people are leading increasingly lonely lives. People are more likely to live alone than they ever have been in the past. We all live more atomized existences. We don't have the same kind of cohesive social groups outside of social media as people, our parents, our grandparents had in the past. So this is maybe something that's getting worse.
Maybe. I think, though, that it's, I don't know whether it's getting worse. I feel like that society's changing, but I feel like we still are able to get human connection somewhere if we need it. I think it's just the way that we do it is different. It's not so much through church or neighbourhood contact anymore, because things have changed slightly, but I think for our clients in particular, often it's because they've had such past negative experiences as children, so they don't have that family sort of connection, if that makes any sense. So most of them are there where they are because they have essentially suffered abuse or neglect as a child.
And does that harm the ability to trust?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, negative childhood experiences can change the way that somebody's brain develops as well. So it can cause just so many things that end up resulting in drug and alcohol use or mental health issues or homelessness, you know, or just social isolation. So I think it all sort of, it's very difficult to tease out what comes first, but I think what we would say with our clients is that 90% of them would have had, at least 90% of them would have had a childhood, traumatic childhood of some description or some kind of trauma in their past.
What made you want to do this kind of work as a nurse, Erin, rather than work in ICU or elsewhere within the hospital?
Well, I did work in ICU, but I love people, I think. So I think I grew up in a church, and, you know, I guess the first thing, you know, church gives you a false sense of what you need to do to help people, I think. They give you that kind of like, you need to be a missionary, you need to go overseas, and, you know, this is how, you know, you get the calling and all that kind of thing. But what I found is that I did a little bit of that. But what I realized when I came to Sydney, I connected with a community of people in a very low socioeconomic area of Sydney. And I realized that I was able to do this here and actually work with people here that were really vulnerable and needed support. And that it actually does, people can do things here. You don't need to go overseas. You don't need to go and work with people from other areas. You can, and that's amazing too. But I found for myself that I just wanted to, even if you make the difference in one person's life, it's making a difference, isn't it?
To be honest, Erin, I'm always hugely impressed by people who do the kind of work you do. And I think in some ways, the real most important people in the world are those who go out every day to not make a terrible thing completely fixed, but just make a catastrophic thing just not too bad. Do you know what
I
mean?
Yes, yeah. Harm minimization at its finest.
Yeah, that's right. So it doesn't look very heroic on the outside, but it is quite heroic. It's not as dramatic as that, but it's just quietly heroic, that kind of work. Are you attracted to that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. And I think you can make such a difference just by, yeah, doing that quiet work, just by changing one person's life, or changing one person's life at a time, you know, or there might be just that one thing that you say to someone that might be the turning point for them.
Yeah, it's not just, there's a kind of an American narrative that goes through our culture, which says that, you know, there was this one day and I turned around this person's life and their life was great after that. We all know that's just not the way life works.
No, it's not. But I think what we do learn, and we work under the model of trauma-informed care, is that you never know when. People do often have that moment. They have a moment that's a bit of that they can go back to that was the turning point for them. And sometimes it is a turning point and they then go back to, you know, so they might be in recovery, but then they might have a slip up and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But generally they can often pinpoint that one thing that somebody said to them, even if it's just saying, welcome, you are so welcome here. We're so happy to see you. You know, like when they come into the service, you know, we're really glad that you're working with us, you know, just being inclusive and welcoming.
So is that turning point a kind of an insight then? Because if they get that welcome, it's like, oh, maybe the world's not entirely terrible. Is that it?
Yes, exactly right. It's not like, you know, what you, that kind of religious thing of being born again or anything like that. It's more that, that moment where they think, actually, maybe I am worth something. Maybe I do have hope. Maybe I can make that work.
So do you go out looking for people or do you wait for people to come to you?
We do a little bit of both, but generally our service is an outreach-based service, so we do go out to see people, yes.
And what does that mean? You go out and you hear a report of someone, you work with other agencies, they tell you there's this guy under the Harbour Bridge. How does it normally operate?
So we do, a bit of both, but generally we do patrols during the week. So we work with like quite a few different agencies to provide lots of different sort of support. When somebody is experiencing homelessness, they have a lot of needs. So if you bring all the agencies to that person at the same time, it's sort of a quicker and more effective way of getting the job done for the things that they might need to triage what their needs are. So generally we'd go out with these services. So we would go, we meet in a park at, say, 7 o'clock in the morning, sometimes earlier, sometimes a little bit later, but generally around 7 o'clock. We split up into groups and we pretty much, we just go around the city, around the streets, walk around the streets together.
And how are you dressed? Are you dressed like you are now, just casually, or are you dressed with a lab coat or something? I don't know. What do you look like? Do you look like a health professional when you're out?
No, actually, I've been quite often actually mistaken for somebody experiencing homelessness myself. You generally...
Are you all right?
I have actually at Central Station a couple of times.
So you look like anyone else on the street?
Yeah, so I would just, I mean, obviously, I think when somebody said to me once when I started in homeless health, you don't want to look, if you're thinking about going to court, you don't want to look like a lawyer, but you don't want to look like you're going to court. If that makes
right.
sense.
You've got to find that sweet spot.
You've got to find that sort of intermediate. Yeah. But yeah, so we do dress very casually when we're doing outreach patrol because you want to be able to engage people. So that means, you know, you don't want to look intimidating. And often people have had past negative experiences with health services. So
and authority, perhaps, as well.
And authority, yes, very much so. Very, very good point. And so we tend to just try and be, you know, not to be intimidating. We approach people sort of just in pairs, even though there might be a group of us. And we would, generally health would not be the first engager, although sometimes they are, but we sort of the housing services would often be the people that would engage and then say, do you have any health issues? And then they would bring the health worker in to say, look, they've identified that they have heart issues and they don't have a GP at the moment. Can you help them?
So given that you're often talking to people who've got the major fight or flight thing going on in their mind,
yes.
How do you approach them? What's the body language? Do you just gently sit next to them or kneel down in front of them? And what do you normally do, Erin, like that?
I think the most important thing is to be very aware of your surroundings and to make sure that people don't feel contained or caged in any way. So it's about making sure that you personally always have an escape exit and that person is not feeling stood over. And obviously, like, we don't usually wake anybody up that's sleeping because that's kind of, I guess, considered fairly rude and people, you don't know what they've been through. So
yeah,
it's a bit of a risk thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think people in comfortable beds can be quite dangerous in that situation.
Yeah, exactly.
So of course.
So it's just about being respectful of that person. You've got to remember too, that person doesn't have a door they can't answer. So say if you were knocking on someone's door to try and give them help and they didn't want to see you that day, they just wouldn't answer the door. But we're going up to people who don't have that barrier, don't have that sort of etiquette. So, you know, they might just say, no, not today, thanks, or they might swear at you. But that's really not about you or it's just about them just saying, no, I don't want to talk to you today, just leave me alone. I'm all good, thank you. And that's fine because you're not going to press on anyone anything they don't want, but we'd always go back and check on them again. So we'd note where they are and we'd be like, okay, well, we'll just go back another day and we'll just make sure that they're okay. So it's just about that persistent and sort of consistent outreach.
A couple of years ago, I was talking to a police officer in South Brisbane who has a really good and quite enlightened approach to homelessness and about how the police officers there approach homeless people, keeping an eye out for people, and there's a kind approach that's taken there. How is it in Sydney? What's the work like you do with police officers in the middle of Sydney CBD?
They've always been really amazing, actually. So police have always been really important, part of the sort of responses we've had to homelessness within the inner city. We don't do outreach with them as such. Often people experiencing homelessness, you know, that would be a massive deterrent for them engaging with you. But they are always, like, we have such amazing relationships with them in terms of getting information about people. If we need to know where they are or, you know, if we're concerned about them, you know, they're really just very, very helpful to us.
Like I said before, there was, at the very beginning, it's the case that people will often come to you when things are really bad with their health because their priorities are elsewhere, getting a bed, finding some food, trying to get hold of some money. How bad does it often get before people actually will come forward and go, actually, I'm now in a pretty bad situation with my health?
Varying degrees, really. So the other way that we work, I haven't explained this yet, is that we provide clinics. So my team provide clinics in the inner city. So we sit in drop-in centres, churches and hostels, and we provide like a doctor that sits there and are usually a very experienced nurse. And they, what they do is they sit in the drop-in centre at around lunchtime or around shower time or around in an, at a time where people are coming in, and they can actually come in and see the doctor to sort of, I guess it's about ED avoidance. So it's like saying, come and see that we try and like get the really vulnerable people who would only ever access ED rather than go to a GP.
The emergency department.
The emergency department. And we would just try and, I guess, get in and make sure, you know, treat simple infections or make sure they're linked into the appropriate services, health services and housing services, and try and, you know,
well,
connect them up that way.
Well, step in before there's a crisis, in other words.
Yeah, essentially.
Otherwise the patient's suddenly in emergency and there's the machine that goes ping and there's everything else and it's massively expensive. And of course the person might be not get such a good outcome from that.
But in saying that, we still have so many people who don't access services. So there's still so many people who will use ED because they don't have a GP, or for so many other reasons, not using a GP is untenable. They don't have ID. They don't want to sit in a waiting room because of stigma. So they can't keep appointment times for whatever reason. The health system is not geared up for people who really are sleeping on the street with a whole lot of other priorities. You know, it takes a really savvy person to navigate the healthcare system. I struggle with it. So if I'm struggling with trying to navigate the healthcare system, you can only imagine what somebody with poor health literacy and all whole manner of other things going on can navigate it.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
How serious can some of these health problems be before someone comes in to get some care from you guys at St. Vincent's, Erin?
They can be extremely significant, Richard. And I guess we've spoken about the Cook Islander boy who had the brain tumour, but we've also had, I guess, looking back through my past experience, we've had another young gentleman who had essentially mouth cancer, which was started out quite minor, but as he ended up, you know, because he was unable for so many other reasons to access health services because he had so many other things going on in his life. And he'd had so many past traumatic experiences, I guess, in his past life, he really struggled to access health services that he ended up, it became extremely significant. And over quite a long period of time, he became more and more unwell. He underwent treatment a couple of times, but really struggled to maintain it. And then it was just extremely hard for him. And in the end, he did pass away. So that, I guess, is a very, very sad case, but it can be as serious as that.
Is it because often that people don't know what they have? I've got this pain in the side that's getting worse and worse. And then the next thing you know, they come to you and they're terminally ill.
I think sometimes the gravity of an illness is definitely misunderstood, particularly if somebody has brain damage or an intellectual disability or, you know, some other reason that they can't understand what's going on. But I think there's also the issue around drug and alcohol use. So sometimes people have had such terrible negative past experiences in their life that they are sort of using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate the pain, but they almost lack capacity over their health decisions because they're so in the grip of that, because the minute that you stop using that, all these things just come flooding back, and it's just a very, very tricky cycle.
Are women less likely to be homeless? Let me rephrase that. Are women less likely to be on the streets than men?
Yes. So you do see less women sleeping rough than men. And that's because women are much more vulnerable, I guess the thinking behind that is. So there's roughly, I think the last census said 40-60 in terms of overall homelessness, and that's in any form of homelessness. So 40% women, 60% men. But generally, sort of women do sit in what is called that hidden homelessness, so couch surfing, caravan parks, hostels, things like that. And that does often mean that they can be much harder to locate or to work with. So they may spend a little bit of time indoors and outdoors, but it can almost make them more vulnerable in some ways because it's harder to help them access services.
Tell me about a woman you were met early on who was sleeping rough and that you became quite involved with over time.
So she was a very special client of mine, I would have to say. It took me a little while to meet her. So this is when, again, one of my first clients, and I went out a few times to the street to try and meet her. She'd been flagged by an agency that does street-based outreach in the inner city as having some health issues. And it took me a little while to meet her. And eventually I kept going out to the CBD with the partner agency to try and find her. And we eventually found her. And I was able to provide a health assessment on her and make sure that she was linked up with a GP, and I supported her to a few appointments to the GP. And we eventually worked with her into getting her housing. And I would say one of the most significant things we did for her, because she was an amazing woman and so many, she had a great sense of style and fashion.
Sense of style and fashion?
Yeah, she
while
was.
While sleeping rough? Really?
Yeah, while sleeping rough. She had a lot going on. She was in a domestic violence relationship and she was quite a heavy alcohol drinker. But she used to find clothes from I don't know where, but she always looked incredible. And the best thing we did for her, I think, almost was get her a pair of dentures. So she got all her teeth removed, her rotten teeth removed, and she got a pair of dentures. And I'll never forget that smile.
What did you find out about her backstory?
So she had a daughter who passed away when she was 9 years old of leukemia. And after that, she really struggled. So she ended up on the street in terrible relationship after terrible relationship and drinking alcohol. And really, I think, just, you know, struggled to really function.
I'm just as a bit of a real curveball here, but do you think there might be in such cases like a connection between that awful tragedy, loss of a daughter, and the domestic violence, insofar as, because people, for whatever reason, blame themselves and it's like, I might deserve this or something. Do you see that? Or is that just absurd?
I think domestic violence is very complicated, but yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot of unworthiness and guilt there, I'm sure. Yeah.
That's part of that. Mm. Was it hard to disentangle her from that relationship where the guy's coming around and beating her up repeatedly?
It was, very, very challenging. Very challenging to disentangle her from that.
And did you take a role in that, or is that a social worker's job? Do you have a role to play in that, because there are health issues there with that, obviously?
I worked with other services and we all played a part in just supporting her. But I think in the end, it's about supporting her where she's at. So often it's very hard in a domestic violence relationship to stay non-judgmental and impartial and not to get over emotionally invested in it, I think. And because in the end, she would often say, "I'm never going to see him again," and then he'd come back. And that often is quite emotionally and I don't know why people take this on emotionally, but I think because they see them in such a state that they do get emotionally invested in it. So, and it was the same with me. I used to see her, you know, heartbroken and crying and physically, she'd obviously been physically assaulted. So, you know, see the bruises and things like that. And then she'd be like, "I never want to see him again." And it's that sort of cycle. It's hard not to get sort of into that. But I think the main thing is that you got to remember that you're there for that person, and when they're ready and it's the right time, then you support them to do something about it, if that makes any sense. And it's very hard to stay almost sort of impartial in that situation, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, like, I don't even know her and I'm feeling this sense of frustration.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what it's like for you in that situation too. But it's not about you, I suppose, is it?
It's not. But I mean, also, obviously, within that, if she was at risk, you would obviously call the police straight away. But it's more often you're dealing with the after effects. Yeah.
Was she safer once she got off the streets and into a refuge?
She wasn't, actually, which was really interesting, because then he knew where she was all the time. So he would then come to that place, and that was a pretty, to be honest with you, a very, very dodgy refuge, that there was quite a lot of women staying in there, and it was supposed to be a domestic violence refuge, but it wasn't well supported. So there was often men turning up there, and it was a very, very, I think it's certainly there's been an overhaul of that particular refuge now, but I think at that time it wasn't well maintained or well funded. So unfortunately it was a pretty bad experience, but this is quite a number of years ago now. And I think things have definitely changed and improved in the area of domestic violence because we do have such an issue with it in Australia.
As a health worker, do you find that knowing someone's backstory is helpful in terms of addressing their health issues?
It's essential, generally, yeah. Because we work under the framework, I guess, of not what is wrong with a person, but what happened to the person. So why are they here? Why are they behaving in this way? Why? You know, like what is causing this? Because people want human connection and they want help and they want accommodation. It's been proven. We've done research on it. And people, I think, often struggle sometimes to engage with services for whatever reason, because of fear, because of lack of trust and all these other things that are going on for them. And this might come out in having like quite what you would look at as bad behaviour, I guess. We would try not to term it that way because it's quite stigmatising terming it that way. But it's just about looking past that behaviour and looking how we can make that person more comfortable and try and reduce either the impact of that behaviour or work with them where they're at so they don't escalate into that behaviour.
Sometimes people in those catastrophic situations have mental health issues or whatever, yes, other issues, and that backstory might just be a whole lot of catastrophic lies all piled on top. Is it pretty easy to spot that when that's going on?
People have their version of the truth. You always try and, I guess it's about, just never really questioning what people say, but also, at times you do have to take things with a grain of salt.
I suppose it doesn't matter either way for you. I mean, a sick person's a sick person, whether they're telling the truth or stuck in a kind of fantasy world.
But you're right. I mean, people do, with mental health issues, may be delusional or have, unusual thoughts, things like that. So, generally we would know that kind of thing, be able to be aware that was happening.
How do you deal with abuse? Because you have to keep an open heart in this kind of work. But you're also, I'm guessing, you cop some really nasty abuse at times in the line of work you do.
Yeah, look, we do. And I think it's really about not taking it personally, because it is not, is very rarely personal. And even if it's directed at you personally, it's really what's about going on for that person. And again, just trying to stay non-judgmental, but it's... just trying to just think, you are a health professional and this person is speaking to you like this, and you're not expected to cop abuse, obviously there's a zero tolerance for violence, but I think it is just about remembering, it's probably more when you're on the street, just remembering you can just step away if that person's behaving like that. Often it's because they don't want to engage with you,
So I'm guessing that given that you do incredibly important work that's incredibly wearing on your spirit, that Australia has the kind of health system that grants people like you tons of long service leave to recharge your batteries so you can just spend time away and come back renewed and rejuvenated time and time again. Seriously, is burnout a risk in the kind of work you do?
It's a huge risk. And you do experience a lot of vicarious trauma, to be honest. And I've experienced it myself, where you're working with someone with an extremely traumatic history, you're getting, hearing about their story and their past trauma, and, you start thinking about it and, start dreaming about it and start thinking about them all the time, and then,
you get up out of bed in the morning.
You need to be really, really on top of that.
So what do you do then? Sometimes you actually do need to stay in bed on that day. I'm not kidding. Culture just isn't good for that. So it's hard to sort of say, actually, because I'm just wondering about the whole state of the world at the moment.
Look, I think there are so many supports in place in the workplace that I work that sort of you would hope that you wouldn't get to that point in the first place. So we have lots of different types of like clinical supervision, and we also have access to the employee assistance program, but we also have a lot of peer supervision and like lots of different, we have a very, very supportive work environment. So we do, I couldn't really fault it, but it is just, I guess, naturally human that sometimes you you yourself fall through the cracks. You know, you, and that's where it's a lot about self-reflection and just being aware of your own mind and what's going on for you, and just making sure that when you need help, you go and get it.
Yeah, because I suppose it's easy to say to yourself, well, I'm feeling terrible, but I'm not as bad as that poor lady whose kid died of leukemia and has got rotten teeth in her head and keeps being beaten up. But then it's not right to think that way.
Exactly. You've really nailed it in saying that. So I think it is easy to look at someone on this, you know, and somebody said that to me before when I've been working with somebody who's sleeping rough. He said, well, you go home to your nice warm bed then.
Ooh.
And I think, you know, and I think it took me a minute. And then I remember one of my amazing coworkers once said to me, you know, like, it's almost like survivor's guilt. It's not your fault that that person's in that space, and you are where you are and they are where they are, and, you know, you can't feel responsible for that.
You said you grew up in New Zealand in a religious family. What kind of religious family was it?
So it was a Brethren family.
Right. Yeah. Exclusive Brethren? I know there's different Brethrens. I know.
There's so many different Brethrens.
Right,
yeah.
Yes.
So my grandparents were Exclusive Brethren, but they left the Exclusive Brethren and joined sort of like a...
less exclusive
Brethren. It was still quite a very, very fundamental sort of closed Brethren church, yeah.
And some of the fundamental beliefs of that church that you grew up with, what were they?
I guess that women weren't allowed to speak in church. They had to have their head covered. They were to be aware of worldly things, and that you needed to go to church all the time, and that going to church is sort of like the gold standard of everything.
And what about people who are outside the Brethren?
So we're a little bit different than the Exclusive Brethren, that we're able to socialise and eat and mingle with people who were not in the Brethren. So I was very lucky in that. It does still create quite a isolative feeling, though, because you still are sort of almost taught that those people are bad and that they need to be saved, and, you know, that kind of vibe, which is an interesting concept.
And were you like that yourself as a kid? Were you a believer, and did you think that about people around you?
Yes, I did, because I didn't know any other way to be. Yeah.
So that mean if you were sitting next to someone who wasn't part of the Brethren, you'd try and bring up something or other in the conversation? Were you evangelical like that?
It's such an interesting question. It's causing me quite a lot of self-reflection here, but I don't think I ever really was like that, because I think I always, maybe sometimes, but I think, you know, as you grow older, you sort of get a sense that that's not really socially appropriate, if that makes any sense.
Well, people get up and walk away
from
you.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It doesn't really win you friends and influence people, does it, often?
So was it a happy childhood nonetheless, for all that strictness and...
Oh, yes. Yeah. I had a very happy childhood, and probably a lot of my wanting to help people comes from my parents and watching what they did. My father took someone under his wing. He'd pick someone up off the side of the road and bring them home and give them a meal, you know, kind of man. And he loves animals and, you know, just a very, very gentle man who really liked to help people. And my mother was the same. They were very, very welcoming. And my grandparents as well, they always looked after people.
So what are you doing working in the middle of Sin City at the moment? And why are you not a part of the Exclusive Brethren anymore?
So I just realised as I grew older and older that I don't think that things are black and white like that. You know, I think that there's so many shades of grey, you know, that I don't think that everyone's going to hell that's not born again. And so as I developed over this time, I sort of realised that I think a lot of their theology or methodology, whatever you call it, is not right. You know, like it just did not resonate with me at all. But it doesn't mean that I don't believe in God and that I don't have a relationship with God. And I didn't feel uncomfortable in that space, because they all were all about, like, if you know better, you'll feel it on your conscience kind of thing. And I never, ever had a twinge of conscience that anything I've ever done is wrong. I mean, occasionally, yeah, I've done things that are wrong, but that, you know, and then I guess the reason I'm here where I am now today and is that I eventually started having relationships with girls. So that really separated me from them and meant that I could never go to that church again.
But it didn't feel sinful.
No, not at all. Yeah, it felt very natural and normal. And I think that what really surprised me, which, so I sat with it for a really long period of time thinking, at some point, is this not going to feel wrong? Am I going to feel wrong about this? Is this going to feel bad? Am I going to feel like I'm going to hell? And not for one second did I feel like any of that.
So you and your wife are newly married now?
Yes.
Yeah. And you got kids as well?
We do.
Was it tough coming out to your religious family though?
It was very, very tough. It was, yeah, I just was very...
How did you do it? Did you say, I've got something to tell you, or did you say, oh, I'm getting married to an interesting person? Oh. You've got to meet her. How did you do it?
Well, actually, I was a chicken for a very long period of time because, see, the thing that I felt bad about coming out was not about religion, not about Christianity, not about God, not about anything. Everything felt right. But I knew that I would essentially lose my family to a certain extent and that it would be very, very hurtful to them because it was like the one thing that they hated more than anything else, essentially.
Oh, and was it hurtful to them?
It was. Mm. It was. And my father, I think, is still hurt, very, very hurt, that, you know, still very, really struggling with it. And I think... But I think in the end, it was like, you know, having that integrity to yourself, you have to do it. And it took me a long time and it took me counseling. I had to go through counseling. And I went, you know, I did the work, did the time and eventually did it. But I did it via email because I just could not envisage myself getting it out of my mouth. But it wasn't that too. I had a lot of fear. I wanted to protect myself because I knew that I'd get essentially browbeaten if I did it in person, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a self-protection sort of thing. It's like, send the email and whatever they send back, I can quickly read, then delete.
So what was it like? What was it like to send the cursor on your computer towards the send button and then go,
oh,
click?
Oh, heart-wrenching.
Was it?
Yes.
Did the cursor tremble a little bit?
More than a little bit, Richard.
Right. And what was your partner doing? Was she leaning over your shoulder going, send, press send? Or
yeah, no, she was. She was amazing. She was very supportive. She, I'm pretty sure, had her finger on the button too.
So the email went off. And what happened after that was sent?
Heartbreak, essentially. Oh. Yeah, absolute heartbreak.
Yours or theirs?
Theirs, yeah. And I think so they...
But you were ready for that.
I was ready for that, but I think their reaction was extreme. You know, my father was like, how can you do this to your mother? She's crying. She's not stopped crying. And there's lots of sort of emotional sort of type, you know, sort of what I would term a bit of emotional blackmail, you know, like, how could you do this to us?
And, to us, yes, yeah.
So then they had to come to Sydney and talk to me in person, and that was extremely difficult as well. That was a very, very difficult interaction.
Well, did they try and talk you out of it somehow or try and get you into therapy or something like that?
They, I guess... In their own way, they tried to talk me out of it. So they sat down, we went to a cafe, sort of tried to go to a neutral place, and they got their Bible out and put it down on the table and said, show me where it says in here that it's okay to be gay, essentially. So that was an interesting experience.
Yeah, you can do a bit of cherry picking around Leviticus with that sort of stuff.
But, you certainly can.
You can, but then you can also say it's acceptable in Leviticus to bring people to slavery, stone people to the gates of the city and all that as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would guess they'd have to respect the work you do. I mean, the work you do really does align with the message of the Gospels. It really does. Mm. Do they respect that?
I think in their own way they're proud of me because my sister had the conversation with him. She is so brave. She really is so strong, and she just said she really got sick of it one day, and I think just the way that they were behaving, and she said, look at Erin, you know, she is doing all these things that are just absolutely the right thing to be doing, and you're just treating her like this, like she's nothing. And they were, and I think she spoke to my mum, my dad wasn't there, but I think my mum was like, yeah, and so my mum's view, and this is so hard, she's like, I think about it all the time. I feel like I have to choose between her and God, and I just can't make that choice. You know, and that's how my mum feels, and I can't even imagine being in that position, really, to be honest with you. And because God is her life. I mean, not only is it their life, the church is their whole social support. It's everything to them. So to give up all that for me is too much for them, essentially.
Having lived such a kind of correct childhood and coming from such a kind of correct family and now spending all this time as you do amongst, you know, badly broken people, do you have a kind of view of human nature? And is there, and do you think there's much distance between the very correct and the very broken?
I guess I think, like, I think the message is really just about hope, because I think no matter what someone's situation is like, there's always hope. And that's what you're trying to help someone discover most of the time when what I do. And I also feel like, too, what this job has really, really taught me. I have worked with people who you would say that you would never want to know, that you would never want to work with, that you would just think were just people that had done the most unspeakable things. But you see good in those people too, which I've never expected, which I think is, for me, was very challenging. And it just, again, brings me back to the fact that there's just no black and white. It's always grey. And yeah, there are people who are genuinely bad who I would not want to, you know, that you would say that are bad people that may not have any good in them, but I've never, maybe only a few times ever seen somebody like that.
You come back on this show in a couple of years and tell me stories again about people you're helping or not being able to help, or how things are going. Will you do that again for us?
Of course. It would be an absolute pleasure.
It's been such a pleasure having you here to tell this story. Thank you so much, Erin.
Thank you, Richard.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Erin Longbottom is a nurse at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, and I spoke to her last year. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.